Hey folks, my name is Mike. I'm the Anglican chaplain on campus here at UTS, and I lead the chaplaincy, and I love working with the Credo staff team. I'm also the senior minister of St. Barnabas Broadway, just down the road. If you ever walk to Broadway, you'll pass by on your right-hand side a big development and an enormous building with a huge cross in the front. And if you don't mind, I'm a little excited about that. We did carelessly burn it down about 6 years ago, and we're rather excited that it's come back to us, and we promise we won't play with matches anymore. Look, I've been asked to do the shortest series on earth. It's 2 weeks. That is pretty much as short as a series can actually legally be, and still we call it a series. God and Stuff. Now, I should flag that after today, if we have time and I don't go too long, we'll throw it open to some questions from the floor. So do listen and jot. And if you're someone, whether you are a Christian or someone who is exploring, who just finds that something I said raises issues, you disagree with something, you want to ask a question, do make sure you note that down. Let's squeeze the very best out of our time here today. Is Thomas nuts or what? Let me reread some of that for you. Just one of the 12, Thomas, was not with them when Jesus came, so the other disciples kept telling him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. And a week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. The doors were locked. Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas is nuts. This is a completely brutal demand for evidence. I have a suspicion. I know that we think we're kind of secular in our age, but I'd be willing to make a bet that if Richard Dawkins or one of the other horsemen of the new atheism apocalypse got up there in public and said something like, look, I'll believe in Jesus if I can stick my hands into the intestines of his body cavity and feel around and put my finger through the bone fragments and shreds of sinew in his hand and poke it out at the other side, I'm willing to bet that he'd be howled down by the culture police. There's just something so raw about it. But this is exactly what Thomas does. This is what you might call rational, scientific empiricism at its very pointiest edge. I don't even notice it. Jesus affirms him. Jesus, in fact, invites Thomas to do just what he wants to do in order to test the evidence. And I'm going to say, for many people I meet and talk to, and I meet and talk to a lot of people about the claims that Christianity make about Jesus, that Jesus makes about himself, for many people I meet, this is really confusing. After all, in the West, in our postmodern secular culture, we know what Christians, we know what the church, we know what Christianity in general is like. We know, for example, the story of the Dark Ages, a time of superstition and violence, when Greek learning was lost, and we know about the Enlightenment coming along, when religion and its grasp on our life was repudiated and free thinking was once again celebrated. We know the story of Galileo Galilei. You guys have heard that story, haven't you? Galileo, who ignored the oppressive dogmatism of the 17th century church in order to demonstrate, to prove the heliocentric nature of the solar system and refute the ignorant, faith-based superstition that had previously held the day, paving the way for scientific astronomy. In fact, so revolutionary was his Copernican shift, if you like, that Stephen Hawking once said that Galileo, perhaps more than any other single person, was responsible for the birth of modern science. I don't think it's any surprise then that you might find someone like Richard Dawkins saying, so faith, I quote, is a process of non-thinking, or of believing because you've been told. And because of this, I quote from him, religious beliefs are irrational. Religious beliefs are dumb and dumber, super dumb. Some of you have heard me quote him before. I just think it's a great quote. Sam Harris wrote a couple of years ago, the conflict between religion and science is inherent and very nearly zero sum. The success of science often comes at the expense of religious dogma. The maintenance of religious dogma always comes at the expense of science. But there is one little problem. Just a small one. And it's this. The problem is, the stories that we have been told and the stories that we tell each other aren't true. They're myths. And this isn't like some breaking case that I've discovered. You know, I haven't gone digging a la Da Vinci Code in some abandoned crypt to bring you this news. It is a known myth. The Dark Ages, for example, is a myth. It is a marketing label which was invented and applied by three 18th century anti-Christian writers, Voltaire, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and David Hume. They did it in order to advance their new mode of thinking. You see, you can't really have an enlightenment unless you've had a Dark Ages, can you? The scholarly consensus is there was actually nothing dark about the Dark Ages at all. I've said some of these things here before, but I just think they're worth revisiting. The Dark Ages is actually now regarded as a time of enormous social and scientific advance. The origin of musical notation. Who here plays a musical instrument? Yeah, a few of you. I'm learning to play guitar. Every time I do it in the house, my wife, Fiona, grimaces because we have four small children and she can see what's coming when they start learning violin and clarinet. origin of musical notation, stirrups on a saddle. Who rides? Who rides horses? Who rides? A few of you? Who has rode? Who once dreamt of being a horsey rider person? Come on, a few. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Can I say, my family once owned horses, and I can tell you from first hand, horses are very dirty animals. Do you know why stirrups on a saddle are important? Historically, you only have to look at the complete and utter rout of Saladin's forces as they moved against the West. You see, you know the image, the Hollywood image. You hear the distant thunder, the rumble of the turf. Maybe someone zooms in on the blades of grass, shivering from the force of 1,000 hoofbeats as two opposing armies come riding against each other. They crest the hill and kind of flow down like a thundering river towards one another. And you know the point. You can see the line where then a crash and it's going to explode and there'll be steel and wood and bodies and horses and it's just going to be a huge... And it's so exciting! Well, until the invention of stirrups, those great floods of horses would ride and they would thunder and then they would stop. And awkwardly, their riders would dismount and then they'd run at each other, which was much less impressive. Stirrups are very important. They allow you to stay on a saddle when you shoot a bow rather than falling off, which is silly and dangerous all at once. The invention of the compass, for example, the crossbow, the eyeglasses, which I'm particularly pleased. The advance of justice, for example, the first major advance, the Magna Carta, which restricted the power of kings. The Dark Ages is a myth. The story of Galileo, too, is a myth. Galileo wasn't a tireless crusader for modern science. He dismissed Johannes Kepler's theory that the planets moved in ovals, even though it fit the data better than his own theory. Why? Because deeply influenced by Greek philosophy, he thought circles were nice. Galileo wasn't anti-Christian. He dedicated his scientific manifesto, the Assayer, to Pope Urban, who loved it. He took his position on the Bible from the great theologian Augustine. His most controversial book was approved by the Inquisition. The truth is that Galileo was both a genius and, in the end, just a jerk. It's hard to tell, to kind of understand this in this kind of modern day of ignorance, even though we think we're not ignorant. But see, Galileo's day, every single person of any kind of social standing was expected to be some kind of natural philosopher, an amateur scientist, in other words. You just weren't anyone if you didn't have your own theories on how the animals came to be so cute, or why the moon and the stars moved as they did. And so every scientific theory was a matter of kind of personal social standing and status. His biggest supporter, Galileo's, that is, against the opposing kind of scientific theories, if you like, was Cardinal Barberini, who later became Pope Urban VIII, who I mentioned a moment ago, in 1623. And what happened was this. When Galileo published his views on the solar system, Pope Urban asked to have his views included as Galileo's patron, to be included in this book. Now, in these days of Galileo, you didn't write a scientific textbook the way you do it now, you know, just kind of all these boring texts. You wrote a play. A play. Imagine that. Hey, art students are suddenly interested in science. You have a play, and you would have, say, three characters, and one would be a fool, and the other one would be a questioner, and then there would be the brilliant philosopher who brings this new dawning light of truth. And so when Urban asked it to have his views included, Galileo obliged and put them in the mouth of the fool. Simplicio. Galileo was a bit of a butthead, really. These are all myths, you see. They're popular myths, and because of their popularity, they actually obscure something extraordinary, which is this. The kind of thinking that we moderns prize and love, the kind of thinking which leads to things like science, that rational, critical thinking, this kind of thinking, and in particular, scientific thinking, actually owes its entire foundations and possibility to Christianity. Now, I understand it's a very big call. It's a big call to make. But let me just point you to some simple facts. Firstly, this. Christianity provided the possibility for science, which is the example I'm going to choose for today, by providing the philosophical ground for science. Did you know that historians are now fairly convinced that none of the world's most culturally sophisticated societies actually produced communities of scientists. In fact, the only place in the world where science arose, science as we understood it, was Western Europe. Now, you got to get how this is weird. Okay, you need to understand just how weird this is, because frankly, Western Europeans, okay, from whom many of us come, we were the thugs of the world. In the first 1,000 years AD, China was just light years ahead of Europe. I won't tell you when Europe discovered toilet paper from China. It's just too gross to imagine those hundreds of years of lying in a bed next to someone who is covered in poop. Islamic scholars had the whole body of Greco-Roman knowledge, yet neither of them developed scientific knowledge. Not even the Greeks developed science, despite all of the anachronisms and mythology which sometimes appears in current textbooks which are poorly researched from a historical perspective. Rodney Stark, who is not a Christian, but rather a leading historical scholar on the Christian contribution to Western culture, wrote, "Christianity depicted God as a rational, responsive, dependable, and omnipotent being, and the universe as his personal creation, thus having a rational, lawful, stable structure awaiting human comprehension." In other words, what happened was Christianity supplied the worldview which was necessary for the development of science. There are two parts to this. Let me just go really briefly talk about those two parts. Firstly, Christian faith understands the world as fundamentally good in a way that the Eastern philosophies don't. So the Bible says God saw that it was very good. Matter, therefore, is not evil, You have to understand this is quite a radical departure from many of the worldviews historically of our globe. Most of the major perspectives of the world have seen the physical world as something from which we want to escape. The Greeks are a classic example of this. I mentioned before that the ancient Roman emperors, when they had their funeral pyre, as their bodies were burned, a cage would be opened so at the last moment an eagle could fly out, symbolizing the spirit wonderfully, blessedly escaping the terrible prison of the physical world. But the Christian worldview understands the world as something good, worth studying, worth investigating, thoroughly wonderful. But secondly, and this is really significant too, Christianity understands creation as that which is not God. It is good but not God. That is, when you look at the world, you don't see in actuality a whole bunch of kind of spiritual beings animating and moving every part of the world. Rather, the world has its own reality, its own way of behaving, a level of autonomy from God. It can therefore have its rules and a system of cause and effect. It was actually, I think, Aquinas in the 13th century who talked about God's mediated work in the world. You didn't need to look at a mechanical system, for example, and go, ah, I saw God do that. And ah, I saw God do that. It had its own system that made sense. This was the philosophical foundation for the study of the world, for the arising of science. The world, okay, is made by God. It is good. But secondly, it is not God. It has its own sense and can therefore be studied. That's a philosophical ground. Secondly, Christianity provided the material ground for science. The historical fact is simply that it was the influence of the great European universities in the 12th and 13th centuries, which developed out of the schools which were attached to Christian cathedrals, that saw science proper emerge in its recognizable form. So I'll give you an idea, right? From the middle of the 12th century to the end of the 13th century, 150 years, 26 universities began. The earliest began about 1050. So 26 universities between middle of the 12th and end of the 13th century. Okay. How many students? 26 universities. They had a total enrollment of 750,000 students. At a time when the population of London never exceeded 35,000. This was a brand new kind of institution. It wasn't a training school for Chinese mandarins, a monastery for meditation. It was an enormously wealthy and privileged institution for intellectual innovation. In fact, so amazing were these universities, so influential were they, that we're used to thinking about them like Oxford, right? Like lots of old stone. But in fact, in their early days, many of the European universities were actually more like traveling carnivals, because individual towns would actually bid. They would make offers, make pitches for a university to move. So the University of Sydney might start in Sydney, but then Canberra would say, hey, guess what? We have lots of space and there's nothing but sheep. Okay, come down here. And so they'd come down there for a while, and then Melbourne would say, no, we will give all your faculty free flat whites for a year. And so the University of Sydney would move to Melbourne, right? And then Townsville would say, we have the Great Barrier Reef and dolphins. And everyone can have a pet dolphin. And so you move up, and so on. And it was at these universities that science, which is that commitment to empiricism and then the formulation of theory, the two have to be tied together. Okay, this is what the Greeks missed. So Plato, for example, when he talked to his students about studying astronomy, okay, his first piece of advice was turn your eyes from the starry heavens. Okay, it was in these universities that the connection between empirical observation and the formulation of theory actually developed. And here's the thing. While Christianity is in no way a Western worldview, okay, the West was thoroughly colonized and overwhelmed by this very Middle Eastern worldview, it was its influence, its total influence in the West, which allowed science to flourish. So Lauren Isley, a senior academic at Stanford University, says, I'm going to quote, "It is the Christian world which finally gave birth in a clear, articulate fashion to the experimental method of science itself. Science owes its origins to an act of faith that the universe can be rationally interpreted, and that science today is sustained by that assumption. Okay, now, I'm assuming that you're here at university because at least at some level you love thinking. And you love the kind of thinking which on many, some of its paths and some of its ways of expression leads to science. And if you appreciate science, whatever faculty you're from, then you do so because you appreciate the way science is a kind of a fundamentally rational employment of your brain in untangling the evidence, a way in which you might apply to other disciplines. I take you're here at least in part because you're kind of good at thinking and you value thinking. Now, scientific method is a great way of thinking. I have a physics degree. I love science. It's a very powerful way of thinking and for gaining knowledge. But it's worth saying it's not the only way of thinking. It's not even the most important one, whatever we may hear in the popular media. You see, here's the funny thing. Almost everything that we think that really matters in our lives, we think because of non-scientific reasons. Let me give you an example. Who here has ever asked someone out on a date? Come on. I'm sure there's more courage in this room than that. Who here has ever asked anyone out on a date? Okay? Yeah. There was when I was in year 10, there was a very attractive friend of mine who I was a little bit keen on, and she actually asked me to a dinner party with 10 people, right? And she must have seen my face light up suddenly. You know, I saw this was full of possibilities and maybe little hints. And so she right away said, "Mike, it's not a date." And as I crawled out of the car, who's ever asked someone on a date? Come on, show me again. How'd it go for you? Okay. Swing and miss, hit for six. Now let me ask you something. Prior to asking that person out, did one night you sneak quietly into their bedroom while they were asleep? This is not going where you think it's going. Take a wire brush to gently scrape the soles of their feet to collect some jewel-like skin flakes. Take them home, put them in some test tubes, clone them, create analogues of the person who is your heart's desire, and then run them through a series of tests and simulations to see if really they liked you. Did you do that? Did anyone do that? Good. It probably means there are no sociopaths here, and that's a great step forward. How about this? I've used this one before, but I like this one. I think this is helpful. Have you ever thought how much later in the morning you could get up if you installed a toaster in your shower? I'm just thinking about it. You could, continuing the skin flakes theme, you could exfoliate and bake a nice sourdough all at the same time, or just toast some Sonoma bread ready for some jam. Think how efficient it would be. There you'd be in the shower, and right there, ready to pop up full of bready goodness, would be your toast. Like, seriously, I mean, like, you would be able to get up not just like at 1 in the afternoon, but probably push that to like 1:30 or 1:45 even. Just the sheer efficiencies of the whole idea is genius. You ever done that? Ever put a toaster in your shower? No? Why not? Soggy bread. Yeah. How do you know? Why not? Why didn't you do it? It'd be a shocking experience. Yes, thank you. There's some funny boys down here. I like that. Yeah. Yeah. But how do you know that? Like seriously, did you borrow the cat and just try it out? Maybe an annoying younger sibling. Is that what you did? Well, no, that's one of the reasons why you're here today, not locked up. You know, because at some point you were told. And even if there's a scientific basis to that, you know, there is something in science that says actually electricity, water, and a human body are not a good combination of things. The fact that you believe it and act on it is not because you've done the test yourselves. You don't know because of scientific reasons. You know because someone reliable has told you. Or at least let me assure you, in this area they were reliable, even if they've proven unreliable in others, in case your parents have disappointed you. I just want to say that clearly. Don't go sticking forks in PowerPoints because you think your parents have failed in so many other areas of advice. You know these things not because of science. You know them because of other reasons, often because you've been told in some way. And that doesn't... Because it's got a different rationale than science doesn't make it less rational as a way of thinking. There are other ways of knowing things than science. One of the ways in which Christianity makes its claims, for example, is through history, which is another amazing way of thinking. It's an investigative method in its own right. It's as old, well, it's older, much older than science, with its own standards of proof. So whereas, you know, scientific proof requires repeatability, history concerns itself with things that happen only once. So when you ask for proof for something like Christianity, you better not be asking for scientific proof. That's as dumb. It's a category area. You are playing in the wrong ballpark entirely, because Christianity makes historical claims. Because history deals with things that can't be repeated. They happened only once. And the claims of Jesus rest on the thinking, the rational investigation about this kind of historical evidence. The second reading you heard today, I'll skim through it for you again, written by a doctor called Luke. He says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning." I don't know if you noticed some of the themes, the words that are echoing in there. But do you see, as Luke writes to his patron, we assume, Theophilus, someone who probably supported him financially as a doctor, someone who is already a Christian, he writes in order that Theophilus might have certainty about what he knows. And where does he get the certainty from? Is it by shutting the eyes and hoping? No, it's by, you know, careful investigation of everything from the beginning. It is about comparison with other accounts, because many people have written accounts of Jesus' life, and to draw them together, and to draw them together not just by second or third hand, by it, but as Luke says, eyewitnesses. You see, friends, perhaps uniquely among all worldviews, including atheism, Christianity insists that there is evidence for its fundamental claims about the nature of reality and of God and of purpose, and that that evidence is something which God himself summons you to use your amazing brains that he has given you, not for them to be left idle, but that you might think, that you might enjoy his world and explore it, that you might think about sociology and history and philosophy and law, but particularly that you might apply your mind to the evidence that he has set before you. This evidence convinced me. I was once an atheist, to become a Christian, because I became convinced by thinking about the evidence that Jesus had risen from the dead and so opened a door for us to God. And I am convinced, I hope you're convinced, that even if you're not a Christian, to be a Christian means to actually delight in thinking hard and evaluating and weighing and questioning. So much so that if you love thinking, I really think that you should probably love Jesus too.